Welcome to this new podcast for EVGI. We are here with Dr. Bajaj, Professor of Medicine of Virginia Commonwealth University and the lead author for this new ACG guideline on hepatic encephalopathy. How are you, Dr. Bajaj?
Well, thank you so much for the invitation, and thanks that EVGI has published such a great resume of our guidelines published in the Red Journal.
Thank you for being here in this EVGI podcast. So we're going to just ask some questions for our listeners to just grab the main points on this new guideline. My first question, I know a lot of people is curious about this first guideline that ACE released on hepatic encephalopathy. Why do you think that there were some points that were under-recognized and that we needed a full guideline on hepatic encephalopathy?
Thank you. I truly appreciate the college entrusting us with hepatic encephalopathy because there are a few reasons. One of them, it is a disease of the entire family. It is not adequately captured by the current MELD score. Patients, and it involves clinical, psychosocial, and financial problems for the patients, as well as the medical system. And last but not the least, it requires separate expertise to manage, not only in the gastroenterologist, but with specialized hepatologists. So therefore, we believed a standalone guideline that studied the many complexities of the syndrome was important.
Yeah, thank you for that. It is definitely a really, really helpful guideline, especially for something that we see in our day-to-day lives. And one of the things that are really, really remarkable on these guidelines is that you leave the definitions really clear, distinguishing between minimal, covered, and over hepatic encephalopathy. Why do you think that having these definitions clear is important for medical practitioners?
Yeah, this is critical to know because people always assume that most of hepatic encephalopathy is when the patient starts getting confused. That is actually just the tip of the iceberg. And the more aware we are about the cognitive dysfunction that many people suffer from before that the patient actually become clinically confused, the better off we can in actually not only managing them, but actually alleviating their stress that we know this happens, this is potentially related to your cirrhosis, and this is what we can do. Alternatively, we can also be the conduit to diagnose things that have not been diagnosed, like MCI, because of patients getting older, or alcohol-related problems, or problems related to obstructive sleep apnea, all of which are comorbid in our patient population. Either way, if we focus on cognitive dysfunction, which is minimal or covert hepatic encephalopathy before the patient becomes confused, we have a chance to intervene and either treat them for their covert HE or refer them to the specialists who can actually alleviate their cognitive dysfunction. Ultimately, we want a happy, healthy, and functional patient who is less likely to develop poor outcomes, and that's what our goal was, to define them adequately.
Yeah, and I think it is really well defined. It is really well distinguished between the three. So extremely important. Thank you for working on that. Now let's go to common day-to-day practice. Like, for example, let's say that someone is seeing a patient with hepatic encephalopathy in their clinic. How do we triage this patient? How do we distinguish whether this patient has to be admitted or go to the ED to think about an admission or just continue at home with management with laxatives?
Thank you for pointing this out. This was one of the novel things that we came up with during the guideline. And of course, this is consensus based on the clinical practice. What we are doing right now is to actually define is by not only by the patient, but what your health system and what your clinical practice currently is. Again, this is very unique to your population and that particular patient. But by and large, if a patient has covert hepatic encephalopathy, which means they're not really confused, but they're not themselves, you can get away with outpatient therapies. And some patients in whom the grade 2 has just recurred and the patient actually can the patient and the family members are very strong. They're very well aware of this process. They've been through this multiple times before. And they know that if they give them a little bit of laxalose, the patient will get better. People who have typical HE that I've just told you, and there's a clear precipitant such as missed laxalose, but there's no suspicion for the other precipitants, and in which the whole system is very good to manage these patients. By and large, patients who come in with confusion, especially grade 3 and 4, for your listeners, of course, grade 2 is when the patient is confused but is awake. Patient grade 3 is when patient is stuporose, but are confused and are lying unconscious, but even you can wake them up. But 4 is the patient is coma. If a patient has advanced grade 2, 3, and 4, those patients need to be in the hospital. If it's the first HE episode or the patient's family members are just not able to take care of them, the patient is agitated, unlikely to comply with lactulose, or has an unclear precipitance, or of course, if there's something else going on, like an infection or a bleeding, which clearly warrant admission regardless of the HE, those are the patients who end up needing ER/hospitalization. By and large, the outpatient management for overt hepatic encephalopathy is few and far between. Covert, by and large, yes. But inpatient management is reserved for people who truly need assessment from a clinical and psychosocial perspective.
Amazing. I think that's extremely clear. Thank you for pointing those points out. And for our listeners, I'm sure everyone has seen an ammonia level being ordered either in clinic or in hospitalization. How useful it is? I know the guideline recommend against it in some scenarios. What do you think about ammonia? Should we still be using it? Is there any role, or is hepatic encephalopathy just a clinical diagnosis?
It's a bit of both, actually. What the guideline says very clearly is to not substitute your clinical judgment for an ammonia level. If you do, or someone else has done an ammonia level, that could add to your clinical judgment, but that should not replace it. For example, a patient with cirrhosis who comes in with a high ammonia level but is completely clear as a bell, you should not label them hepatic encephalopathy and start them on lactulose, because that is not the case. Ammonia is a liver function test. As your liver gets diseased, the ammonia level will go up over time. But there is no cutoff that tells you that this person has HE. It's only the clinical diagnosis. The vice versa is also true. If someone comes in with absolute confusion and coma, they have cirrhosis that you already know, but the ammonia level is normal. That is a patient that you should think of other cognitive diagnoses. But you've already done the clinical assessment. You have not conflated the ammonia level with the clinical assessment. It is a very important thing. So a random ammonia level in a patient who is completely okay, but should not guide your management. What really the guideline stresses it is a clinical diagnosis. And if someone has done the ammonia levels, that helps you, that's fine. But you should not replace your clinical judgment with the ammonia levels. In acute liver failure and urea cycle disorders, which this guideline did not cover, ammonia levels do have a one-to-one correlation with mental status dysfunction in patients with those diseases. But in cirrhosis, it is not one-to-one. There is no clear cutoff. So if someone is drawing ammonia levels, just make sure they also take care of the clinical diagnosis. And last but not the least, ammonia levels are highly variable. They are also very variable with fluid status. You have to do it within 30 minutes in ice. And if it's not done appropriately, you know, garbage in is garbage out. So you will be actually managing a false ammonia level in addition to not relying on your clinic. So again, clinical judgment is supreme. Ammonia levels, if drawn, could be helpful, but not the be-all and end-all.
Extremely interesting points, and a lot to definitely discuss in the future. Finally, let's talk a little bit about liver transplant. So the guideline argues that HE, hepatic encephalopathy, is not adequately capturing MELD 3.0. And maybe patients are dying more or having more mortality while in the wait list if they suffer from recurrent hepatic encephalopathy. Should hepatologists be offering more often living donor liver transplant if your patient has a low MELD score and recurrent HE? Or what are your recommendations for this?
Thank you for bringing this out. This is more of a philosophical thing, because clearly the MELD 3.0 tried to improve over things and it did not appreciably increase the mortality benefit for patients with HE. Part of it really has to do with how we code hepatic encephalopathy. It is still a little more subjective than we would like, but we have also done analysis using natural language processing, so ensuring that if someone is hospitalized within clear-cut HE episode, that can potentially be used to add to their risk profile. Given that we live in the situation where we are right now, it's going to be very difficult for us to improve the MELD 3.0 for a little more time. In between, the guideline also goes through what to do if the patient keeps on recurring. Find out whether the patient has, you know, another hidden risk factor, whether the patient has HE at all, whether the patient has combination of HE with something else, or whether they have persistent splenorenal shunts. The assumption is if all of these are assessed and the patient still keeps on coming back, then that patient is at risk of morbidity, then followed by mortality. to the point then the, even if their MELD score rises, they may not be a good transplant candidate because of severe sarcopenia or persistent confusion. In those cases, since time is brain, and if there is a living donor available, we have a very weak recommendation, but it is there to consider living donor transplant in that situation. So clearly, ideally, if someone is able to do, has a high enough MELD score to do a deceased donor, that's what the U.S. system is built for, and it is much more likely to get people get fit into that system well. If not, clearly, we want to make sure that the patient has all the the risk factors for recurrence have been resolved, and if the patient still continues to recur, only then maybe a living donor could be considered earlier on before the patient has too many episodes.
Great points that have been brought up. You know, the guideline is really broad and there is a lot that we cannot cover, but hopefully with these points, there are really important topics that has been covered and discussed. So thank you, Dr. Bajaj, for being with us in this EVGI podcast. And thank you for our listeners to be here with us and listen to our podcast again.
Thank you for inviting me, and on behalf of my co-authors and the Red Journal and the ACG, we thank them for commissioning this.